Okay, so the organiser, Ellen, has asked me to chair this session. And this is a session on the magnetorotational instability, or MRI, and we have a lot of speakers this afternoon. So in order for us not to overrun, I'm going to be very strict. So I'll just let Ellen start off to give you an introduction to the MRI.
Thanks. So this is meant for those of you who don't work on the MRI, don't have experience with it. Astrocritical accretion always has to surmount an angular momentum barrier. So it tends to happen from a disk around the compact object onto which the material will be accreted. Molecular viscosity is too slow to transport angular momentum at the rate required, and so for several decades, turbulent transport mechanisms have been sought. In terms of the equation for angular momentum evolution, so if L is the angular momentum density, it obeys an equation something like this, minus 1 over r d by dr, r squared t r phi. So t r phi represents the torque. And in a kind of ominous development for the future interface of this field with dynamo theory, the standard parameterization of this term was due to Shakura and Sanyaev, and it's called the alpha disk. And they made the ozots, so we will call it alpha Shakura Sanyaev. So the alpha disk makes the ozots that PR phi can be written as a dimensionless parameter alpha times the pressure times d log omega d log r, and omega is the local angular velocity in the disk. And the reason behind this is sort of that we instead wrote TR phi in terms of turbulent stresses like this, rho delta vr delta v phi minus the magnetic part, delta Vr delta V phi over 4 pi, and forgot about magnetic fields. And you said, well, the velocity, the fluctuation velocity is some fraction of the sound speed. Then if you had sonic turbulence, an upper bound would be alpha of about 1. But from estimates of the actual accretion rates in these systems, the sort of target alpha Shakura-Sanyaev is a few percent. So it's a dimensionless parameter that the observations require to be less than 1. So there was a lot of work on possible sources of turbulent viscosity, some of it by people here. But in the early 1990s, Steve Valpas and John Hawley reintroduced to astrophysics an instability which had actually been discovered independently by Chandrasekhar and Velikov a few decades before. And that instability has become known as the magnetorotational instability, or the MRI. And so what I want to do is just give you a few properties of the MRI and a few questions that subsequent speakers will address. So so a disk is MRI unstable if omega decreases outward, and the way to see the mechanism for MRI just roughly would be something as follows. If we have an accretion disk like so, with a magnetic field passing through it and the angular velocity is like so, and then we take two parcels that are on the same field line and we move one of them out, a little way and the other one in a little way, then the one which is moved in will be going a little bit faster, have a slightly larger angular velocity than the one that was moved out. So magnetic tension will transmit angular momentum. It'll try to bring that field line back into co-rotation. And so angular momentum will flow from the particle that was displaced inward to the particle which was displaced outward, and that will cause it to fall in even further. Okay. So without a magnetic field, these two particles which just oscillate radially, but with a magnetic field, the particle that's displaced inward falls inward even more. Okay. So
that's it.
Was that 15 minutes?
No. That's the whole story, right?
Basically. So a local analysis of that system that I just drew comes up with the following features of the MRI. So if K is the vertical wave number and the local alphane speed is VA, then if KVA divided by omega is less than the square root of 3, that mode is unstable. So there's an upper bound on K that just comes from magnetic tension, so very high K modes are really just like alphane waves. The fastest growing mode K max VA over omega is the square root of 15 over 4, and the maximum growth rate, gamma max, is 3/4 of the local omega. And all these numbers are for a Keplerian. Okay, so the growth rate is fast. It's of order the rotation time. It's often said that the magnetorotational instability is a weak field instability, and that derives from the following. So the disk has some height, h, and if you impose vertical boundary conditions, then kh must be greater than or equal to of order pi, something like that. The scale height h.
We should pull up the laundry and let Ellen have the whole board. Is it Tobias?
Well,
make it work.
I don't get enough exercise.
I think the moderator needs more exercise.
He'll get it. Okay, so KH has to be greater than or equal to something of order pi. H is the speed of sound of a disk divided by omega. And if you put this together.
Ellen, you're trailing your mic.
You mean some of what I said was lost to posterity?
No, I'm sure it isn't.
Okay, so if we put this together with that, we find that the ratio of the alphane speed to the sound speed has to be of order 1 or less in order for the unstable modes to fit into the disk that asserts size. Okay.
What happens in the limit then as VA goes to 0?
I addressed that question in a paper with Julian Krolik a couple of years ago, and we used a cold kinetic theory for it, so we went beyond MHG. And what we found is that there's really always a growing mode, with the fastest growing mode always has KVA over omega of order 1. But of course, as the alphane speed gets very small, the wave number gets very large, and then there are various damping processes. So in a collisional disk, there'll be diffusive dissipation. Collisional disk is less clear.
What is a bit surprising? I mean, I think I know the answer, but it's going to be surprising for some, but going really to the limit, to VA zero, something different happens, because but you get extremely weak field. What is it, the feature of this theory, that gives you an effect?
Well, so it turned out to be very robust. So as VA gets smaller and smaller, the ions and the electrons decouple. The ions peel away from the E-cross sequence because of their greater mass. The mode is then carried in the electrons. As you make VA even smaller, it becomes almost an electrostatic instability, which makes its own current fluctuations. But I think that in that regime, you have to do a warm plasma theory, and I'm not sure that what we got really survives.
Well, the problem is that, we're in the context of just MHD, ordinary MHD, with none of these other plasma effects, and yet this is still unstable if omega decreases outwards when the magnetic field is non-zero. But if the field is zero, then circulation has to decrease outwards. And the tiniest magnetic field changes the criterion in an order one way.
Well, yeah, I think the persistence of the instability down, to these almost singular wave numbers is because we didn't really consider thermal effects fully. I think that just diffusion, thermal diffusion at some scale must wipe it out. I don't know, would you agree with that, Pat?
I worry about dissipation. Yeah.
There is dissipation.
I mean, it's a well-posed question, right? To ask, you can have a perfectly legitimate warm collisional fluid and look at the B equals zero limit. So that dodges all the collisionless kinetic goodies, right? And which is, I think, what Keith is skewering us with.
Well, yeah. So there's strong viscous damping.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue is the validity of the ideal MHD and approximation, even at the level of diffusion, as you get driven to high K. Maybe the first line of defense, at least, without bringing out plasma physics.
Well, what's the growth rate look like, Ellen, as a function of VA?
It looks very boring, like that. So this is K equals zero.
So you're plotting it for an ideal.
This is ideal MHD.
You're plotting it for. Well, you're plotting it as a function of K. Okay, so that's not an ideal.
This is just what's embodied there. If you then add viscous effects,
you'll get something like this. So this is a fixed B.
B. Yeah. That's right. And then as you make B smaller and smaller, this thing gets
translated to
higher and higher K.
And if you have resistivity, then that's right.
One would think resistivity is probably the more relevant dissipation mechanism here, right?
Either resistivity or viscosity. We've done the theory for both, and it depends on the system.
It depends on the
pattern. Okay, so there were just a couple of other things I wanted to say. So the companion paper to the Ballas and Hawley 1991 paper was Hawley and Ballas 1991. And that was a numerical simulation of the MRI. So really from the beginning, simulation of the MRI of nonlinear amplitudes has been a cottage industry. And some of the speakers are going to address this. So I wrote down a few questions. that I think we'll get some answer to or some path on. So one question, does MRR turbulence transport any momentum outward? And is the alpha SS parameterization reasonable? That's one question. Other question. How does the MRI saturate? This is not agreed on. Does the MRI generate a large scale field? So I think these are the scientific questions. And then some of the operational questions that have come up are global versus local treatments. Are the computations converged? And assuming that all these are understood, the effect of various dimensions parameters and boundary conditions. So I'm hoping that at the end of this discussion, we'll either have answered some of these or have some sort of plan for maybe what we'll play with.
Yeah, I was going to say that I know about a work by Sébastien Fourmont and Monsieur that say that it depends a lot on the magnetic Prandtl number.
Yeah, that work is on the wiki.
Okay. So then you have a problem because the MRI disappears when you have a small magnetic Prandtl number.
No, I'll stop. So we'll just talk about that. Don't worry. He's going to talk about it.
Now, I have a quick comment, which was going back to what Keith was saying. But it's one of the issues of this thing is that it's invisible in your this rectangular shearing box approximation. There's no length scale. You know, you've got this arm together, you don't know what to do with, and the only thing you come up with is the Alpen scale. And then you think, okay, you make the options be smaller, it's the same as before in a tinier box. And so that's fine, it's really singular to be a to zero, because it has no other scale. If you put in diffusion, you have a scale there.
And a finite disk, you have another scale, of course.
If you have a finite disk...
Yeah, but the scale height is the VA goes
not
to
the,
zero.
Not the zero one. I mean,
no.
You can't be bigger than the disk, but you can be as small as you want.
Yeah. Right. Right. But you could be as big as the disk, or you could be zero.
Right. But his question was, what happens if you go to zero field? Well, zero field is the same as finite field in a little box.
Yeah. Well, viscosity will cut it off.
If you have a thing.
Actually, let me make a comment. So there's been some work on the MRI in collisionless disks with an anisotropic pressure tensor. And when the pressure tensor is anisotropic, the wavelength, even for weak fields, stays longish. So anisotropic stresses can also destabilize the MRI as well as magnetic forces.
I give the answer to my question. If the field is very weak, then it's going to get, you have this little perturbation of the radial direction. It's then drawn out. It only is a function of R. It's drawn out in the azimuth, and you have very, you know, it may take a long time, but the azimuthal field will build up and up and up without limit. And ultimately, that is what is affecting the stability.
The azimuthal field becomes unstable.
Yeah. it well, contributes in a vital way to the instability, yes. But however weak the original axial field might have been.
But it's a linear stability analysis. That sounds like you're kind of winding it up to change the basic state.
Well, it does. I think that is, when you look at the details of it, I think that is, there is a strong B theta that developed.
It's not the B theta by itself that does it. It's going to be the Lorentz forces that
Matches
basically the B theta and a BR.
Yeah, sure.
It's just like, you know, if you have to wait a long time, you can rescale it with a stronger field, make it shorter and longer this way. So that's the thing. You're back to the fact that you have no other scale. So it's the product of this.
Sorry, I think it's a simple question. Anyway, these instability results, they come from some sort of radial element or energy argument or what?
You can do just a linear.
Local.
Local.
Okay, so Ed Guzman is talking about. He's next.
Next in the
batting order.
And no one has told me what I'm supposed to do.
How long am I supposed to shoot? Aim for 15 minutes and then we'll take it.
The floor will collapse after that.
Okay, so I've been working on this problem with Peter Julian for a while, and we are particularly interested in the saturation of the MRI. And so I just want to make a few general remarks about what we've done. I mean, I could give the details of this if people are interested at some point, but let me say several things which are connected to what Ellen has just said. So the basic picture is an accretion disk which is threaded through by a vertical magnetic field or a colloidal magnetic field. If the angular velocity decreases outwards, as is the case for Keplerian disks, you have this this MRI instability. So this is a situation that is really stable, but is unstable to this magnetic field driven instability. Now, there are attempts to study this instability in the laboratory. There are several experiments. Dan Lathrop in Maryland has one such experiment. Antal G in Princeton is also doing an experiment which is not online at this point in a Taylor Couet apparatus. And of course, there is the Rossendorf experiment done by Frank Stefani and Gevers and people like that. The important thing I would like to mention is that I personally do not believe that the experiments have anything to do with accretion disk physics. And the main reason for saying that is not just the values of the parameters that can be reached in the laboratory, but the fact that in the laboratory, of course, you have your fluid, your conducting fluid, confined between rigid walls, and the rigid walls can maintain a pressure difference, which can balance the rotational flow in the fluid. And this is not present in an accretion disk. In contrast, in an accretion disk, of course, the basic energy for the instability comes from the shear, and the shear in turn is maintained by the gravitational field of the central object, right? So that is a primary difference between laboratory experiments and an accretion disk situation. I'll say a few more words about this. So we have been interested in looking at the nonlinear evolution of this instability. Now, this is a complicated problem, and we're going to hear more about this, I'm sure, from Fausto and people like that. But I want to say two things about this. That the answer that you get will depend on how you formulate the problem. And I don't just mean boundary conditions and things of that type that Ellen mentioned at the end, but whether you are using a local approximation, this kind of shearing model, which I can discuss in a little more detail later on. It's basically you take a local patch in an accretion disk. You can assume, for example, that you're periodic in the vertical direction along the rotation axis, and either periodic in the radial direction, but the fact that you have a local patch means that you are throwing away these hoop stresses that Keith has just pointed out. And in fact, it turns out that the an imposed toroidal field that you might imagine is present in a disk, or if it's not, it's going to be created by the omega effect from the imposed toroidal field, that actually decouples from the problem completely, if it's just a channel kind of situation. And these hoop stresses do, of course, produce Lorentz forces, and they will affect the ultimate state of the instability. Now, what are some of the important mechanisms for saturating the instability? Now, I personally favor the first two here, but there's a number of different effects that are important and that really ought to be considered in detail. I'm going to say a little more about the effect of ohmic diffusion, which I'm thinking of as a model of magnetic reconnection within the MHD approximation, and also viscous effects. I believe that an important way that the instability grows is by, you know, it grows by extracting energy from the shear flow. And of course, that means that the basic shear profile is going to be altered by the growing instability. And this is where the primary difference between the lab experiments and the accretion disk come in. Because in an accretion disk, the shear profile, of course, is being maintained by the central object. Whereas in a laboratory experiment like a Coet-Taylor apparatus, you can maintain substantial changes due to the growing instability in the linear profile that's imposed by the boundary conditions. Now, you also have Lorentz forces, of course. I've already mentioned those. You may have wave generation, which carries energy away and perhaps deposits it in other parts of the disk. Jeremy Goodman has talked about parasitic instabilities generated, or secondary instabilities generated by the MRI instability. Basically, you should think of the instability as producing sheets. So this is the vertical direction. You have sheets of angular momentum moving like this. And of course, that generates a shear profile in this direction. It's going to be weaker in general than the shear profile in this direction. But nonetheless, you can get shear instabilities of this type. And there's a possibility that those may lead to some kind of saturation. Now, two things I want to say here is that the saturation process is an inherently nonlinear problem. And so one should pay attention to that. And that it is fundamentally multi-scale. This is what comes out of my work with Keith Julian. Let me just give you an example of how we think about this. You have the growth rate of the instability, which is the growth rate that was mentioned by Ellen a moment ago, which is basically the period of the temporal shear, locally at least. So that I can think of it as a fast time scale. Now, in general, there is another time scale, which has to do with the alpine speed across some local region, travel time, alpine travel time. And if the ambient toroidal field is weak, then that is going to be a much slower time scale. So you already have two time scales in the problem. And I haven't even talked about dissipative processes like reconnection and viscosity, which in accretion disks, given the scales involved, are going to be much smaller or much longer up in terms of time scales than the time scales I've already mentioned. And these scales are all very, very different. And the theory that we have developed is based on this scale separation. We basically think of the growth rate of the instability as being 1 over epsilon, where epsilon is a small parameter. We think of this alpha in travel time of being order 1, and then the diffusive or dissipative processes as being of order epsilon in growth rate, or decay rate, I should say. And we take the limit formally as epsilon goes to 0 and develop a nonlinear, fully self-consistent theory. But in this local approximation, so we're ignoring hoop stresses and things of that type. Since I only have a few minutes, I'm not going to go into the the details of this theory, but let me say a few things that come out of that. The first thing that we find based on this local approximation is that this kind of turbulent viscosity, or the this is sort of equivalent to Ellen's alpha, although I'm not doing a compressible disk, I'm doing a Boussinesco incompressible disk, is that this viscosity term is in general small in our asymptotic theory. It's a order of this epsilon that I mentioned. The other thing that we find, so this is a nonlinear calculation, this is a nonlinear calculation, the wavelength of the instability as it grows increases. So this is the wavelength in the vertical direction, and it grows because this thing that we call B prime, which is the modification to the background shear profile, is increasing as a result of the growing MRI. Now, the theory also shows that we need both viscosity and ohmic dissipation to actually saturate the instability. But this is on the very slowest timescale, right? So this is on the dissipative timescale. But if you want to look for an asymptotic state, then you need to include nu and eta, and I believe that in order to try to capture that in any numerical simulation, you must be able to resolve the scales that are relevant for that process, and I think we'll hear more about that. Now, our theory obtains exact nonlinear solutions in this limit, which correspond to these sheets that are moving through each other. But of course, this is a laminar solution, and you might ask, you know, what is the use of a laminar solution? But I think generally, and there are a number of examples of this, is that the laminar solution is actually not a bad way to try to estimate things like the Reynolds stresses and the Maxwell stresses that drive they are responsible for producing the modification to the background shear profile, the Kepler shear profile. Now you might ask whether the saturated state is a stationary state. And I think this is something that people do not really discuss in the literature, at least I haven't seen this. But I think that there are some interesting issues here. And the way I think about it is really as, not in terms of modes, but perhaps solving some kind of initial value problem with a localized disturbance. And if I examine the evolution of that localized disturbance, then what I really need to think about is the growth rate, lambda, of the MRI, so this is the gamma that we mentioned here, relative to what I call a healing time scale. So if you imagine that you have that the MRI grows very rapidly locally, then locally it's going to extract energy from the shear profile. And the question then is whether that growth rate is more rapid than a defect in the profile, a local modification to the shear, is going to heal. So I call that a healing time scale. And estimates suggest that if you deform the shear profile in the gravitational field of a central object, it's going to heal on a time scale of order, the rotation rate or rotation period. But there's also the possibility that you know, you might be in this regime where the growth rate, I'm sorry, so this is the growth that is faster than the healing length. And then what's going to happen is that locally you will extract you will extract energy from the shear profile, you will modify it locally, and then basically the thing, the instability stops, the profile relaxes, then the instability regrows, and you can get oscillatory or time-dependent a saturated state. So I think it's jumping to conclusions that the final saturated state of this kind of instability should be a steady state. It could be much more complicated. Now you might ask, if the instability is really saturated by extracting energy from the shear, then of course it's going to modify it, it's going to reduce the shear. But the overall shear is maintained by the gravitational field of the central object. And so a plausible evolution...
I think you're opaque.
Plausible evolution of the instability is that it actually produces local regions where the shear is suppressed due to the presence of the MRI, and then you have a relatively abrupt shear layer, then it's suppressed shear, shear profile and so on, this kind of step-like structure. The reason I think this is a plausible way that the instability could saturate is because the equations bear a lot of similarity, mathematically speaking, to the problem of thermohaline staircase formation. There's some mathematical similarities between that problem and this one. Basically, they're both fingering instabilities and the nonlinearities are similar. Because this instability is not a secular or diffusive instability, it's a dynamical instability. But I think that this kind of a process should be considered. And we know from the theory of the staircase formation in thermohaline, solving the regime, that it's very difficult to actually numerically simulate and capture these secondary instabilities that would be required for that.
I presume you see this as a kind of dynamic state and not,
yes,
not static.
No, it's not static. It's all turbulent.
Right.
But I think that the idea that everything is necessarily smooth, from the inner radius of the disk all the way to the outer radius is not by any means a given. And then the last thing I want to mention, and my time is probably up, is global aspects of the problem, and that is the fact that the disk, of course, is not just a local patch, but really is a disk, and it will have field lines in the toroidal direction. That introduces hoop stresses, and if you look at that situation in contrast to the local discussion that Ellen gave us, you find that the initial instability becomes a half bifurcation, an oscillatory instability. So it really changes the nature of the instability in a fundamental way. And the other thing, of course, that the fact that if you're solving this problem in cylindrical geometry is that you actually get a direction for the transport of angular momentum. If you just have a local patch, there's no difference between going this way and going this way, and so there's no a priori direction of the transport of angular momentum. It could just as well be inward, right? And so you really have to impose that as a boundary condition to say that the angular net angular momentum transport is going to be in what you think is the upper direction. So that problem, this local patch problem, is a very degenerate problem, and it's missing certain, I think, key ingredients of the full problem.
I'm going to talk about global models.
But there is a gradient, right? That picks a direction, so...
Yes, that's right. So of course, you can. There are all kinds of bells and whistles you can add to this picture. And one, of course, is radial stratification, and that will pick out a particular direction.
No, the shear itself?
Oh, okay. That's right.
No,
can
the shear,
assign only, that's
the
right.
Shear doesn't, no, that doesn't pick out in that direction.
But if you put in curvature.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Curvature is key, actually, to picking out the direction for the transport of angular momentum.
But that can be put into just a shearing box.
Yes, yes, you can. But the point is you need to think about that. It's not enough just to look at a plain piece of the disk. So I haven't given you any of the theory that we've done. The theory is very idealized, but it suggests certainly that that these sort of issues are going to be potentially significant for the saturation.
And the details on the web.
Yeah, I put one article on the web.
You're obviously talking around the point, Edgar, of looking at some kind of nonlinear diffusion or Fisher-type equation for the propagation of one of these defects. right? Because ultimately you would expect, since the instability locally is gradient driven, there would be, in a sense, a coupling in their evolution between the local instability and the angular momentum transport, and actually also the magnetic field, as I'll get into. And that points to a structure of that sort. Have you looked into that?
Oh.
Because, I mean, that could give a much faster adjustment, shall we say, than one might naively expect on the basis of kind of diffusive transport estimates.
I mean, I've not thought about it quite that way, but I have thought about this issue of porcelain, you know, because the way I have some simulations, which I could show, but the way as the instability evolves and becomes more and more nonlinear, the wavelength in the vertical direction keeps growing. And it's in the simulations of our, you know, reduced equations, basically the only thing that saturates the length scale in the vertical direction is the size of the box. And so you can write down some equations, you know, for predicting this porcelain problem.
I'm thinking more about looking in some sense at a nonlinear propagation in the radial direction.
Yeah. In the models we have done, we don't have a preferred radial direction because
okay, you could, as we say,
we have done all this. We have all the equations for cylindrical geometry, but they're more complicated, and we have not solved them as yet. So.
Have any of your reduced systems admitted the possibility of a layering, as you mentioned in the sort of thermohaline analogy, where this is your sort of thoughts on how it
it's
might
a hunch,
be?
But you know very well that you've worked on this for a number of years, is that in the thermohaline problem, it's very difficult to get the staircase formation, and you typically get, you know, just one layer that spans the whole domain. And this may well be a similar situation that arises here.
And yet the thermohaline staircases are very stable.
Absolutely, and they certainly observe.
So I have a question then.
Yeah.
To do the difference between experiments and accretions. In experiments, you might expect to get very thin boundary layers in each of the experiment, and then everything to go essentially flat or whatever in the middle. So you're saying that can't really happen here, and therefore you might get.
Well, that's one way to think about it. We can, in the way that we do this problem, we can put in two horizontal scales. Basically, the scale I've been talking about, which is kind of the bulk scale, and a scale that describes the thickness or thinness of the boundary layers in the radial direction. You have real rigid boundaries. It's just a standard multiple scale in the horizontal, except you have the vertical scale as well. So you can do that, and that can be simulated, and you see the formation of the boundary layer.
Right.
But if you have periodic boundary conditions, of course, then you don't form the shell. But I think there's a big difference between looking at, you know, just single modes, which is what most people have been doing in this area, and how those might evolve, and actually looking at localized perturbations, packets.
Right.
They behave very differently, and something to bear in mind is, you know, modal analysis of these kinds of problems are
tricky.
Okay. I understand what you're saying is that at each radius you'd have a slightly different frequency to take account of the local velocity. Is that what your steps correspond to?
Well, you could think of it that way. But I think these steps could well form even without that, even if you just had a strictly linear shear profile.
So I've encountered something like that in weakly nonlinear equations for spherical correct flow, where frequency is different at different latitudes, and you get essentially packeted modes which existed over a range of latitudes at one frequency, and then they decay away from that that range. So you do have a sort of step structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you've worked on things of that type.
Instead of having a sort of continuous frequency change, basically you get discrete changes in frequency, which leads to packeted solutions.
Yeah, that's essentially what I'm saying, I think that's essentially what I'm saying. And because you have these, shear layers just connecting things up. At least it's something to bear in mind. It's not been excluded, I think.
There are some numerical simulations that get thrown at A-line staircases now.
But there are?
Yeah. Oh,
Timor Leste. I look forward to hearing more about that.
Nick will read you the papers.
Bedtime story. Okay, can we move on to... Thank you, Edgar. Whatever. Can we move on to Pat? Sorry.
I'm not the only primitive consumer.
Everybody's being primitive.
I know. All right, so I also have played on and off with this problem over the years. I started with Ethan, embarrassingly.
Wait, Pat, do you want to put the mic on?
What?
Edgar escaped, but do you want to put the mic on?
Oh, yes, so I can be recorded for posterity.
Yeah. You were just about to say that I was embarrassing to you.
No, I was an embarrassingly long time ago, wasn't it?
We were younger.
I know. Young.
So there's
not,
a direction.
You're older, but not wiser. Anyway, but this is a comment, really, on aspects of the recent paper that I was a relatively small player in, the big player being Frank Hsu. And it deals with a kind of mean field MHD for magnetized certain stellar accretion disks. And one of the things I get a kick out of this discussion is I sit now in UCSD in the building with the astrophysicists, and the idea of a single type of disk is not consistent with the reality that I observe on a day-to-day basis. And there's an entire zoology of different limits of this sort of game. And this is particularly motivated by magnetized circumstellar disks, in other words, star disks for forming stars around young stellar objects. And sort of to put it in the context of the discussion as it's evolving, Ellen discussed sort of the basics. Edgar kind of discussed what I might call the envelope equation view of the problem. I hope you don't find that too pejorative a generalization. And this kind of discussed the macroscopics. And the good news is that in this particular talk, there is no notational confusion about alpha. The bad news is, unfortunately, there is notational confusion about beta. As you might guess, that means the idea that turbulent resistivity is a central output of this discussion. And so hence, we tried to resolve numerically notational confusion by referring to the turbulent resistivity as eta t. And the point, if you ask what's going on here, is that young stars tend to accumulate mass from cloud cores via disk accretion. So you'll have, a giant molecular cloud that starts to collapse, forms a core. The core collapses, forms a disk. The disk is the thing accretes. The star is born, and the star continues to accrete through the disk. All this goes along in an environment where the interstellar magnetic field has been dragged along for the ride, or maybe not for the ride. And of course, since B over rho is frozen in, the issue of forming the disk is certainly a compressible story, then the B can be amplified. So you can really, one could argue that there are at least a class of disks that are threaded by an external magnetic field that creates a finite flux through the disk. So you have a situation where you have an accretion flow, okay, you have the external magnetic field threading the disk, and of course then there is a kind of angle of inclination between the external field and the field of the disk. And kind of the bottom line, which is immediately obvious, is that unless you want to build up mega-Gauss magnetic fields on the star by accreting all that external flux onto the surface of the star, there must be some slip of the field and fluid during the accretion process. Otherwise, the field is stuck and it goes along for the ride. So you kind of If you like cartoons, which is the key to success in astrophysics, certainly. Just think of the mileage Parker got out of his 55 cartoons. We're all still using it, right? And, anyway, you have a situation where the field threading the disk has to be deformed and in some sense pinched off to separate the field from the fluid and allow accretion to occur. So what this tells you is that some form of reconnection or turbulent resistivity, in other words, some kind of mean field magnetic diffusion, is absolutely necessary for accretion in these circumstances. And this is, I think, feebly interesting because one is continually talking about an effective turbulent viscosity, which is alpha Sikora Sonnaya, or continually talking about some sort of dynamo, but there must be, of course, a turbulent dissipation mechanism. And then this raises all sorts of questions about the interplay of this with said dynamo, or with, for example, the dynamics of the instability. And these, I think, are fertile problems for discussion here. The other thing that's interesting is that we shouldn't be a surprise is that for steady accretion, there is a link between the turbulent resistivity and the turbulent viscosity. Okay, and here, by the way, this is a terribly primitive analysis. It's at the level of the simplest possible thing you can do, so we treat both the momentum flux and the flux of magnetic field is at the level of a Fickian diffusion and parameterize each of them as a single parameter. And certainly well aware of the shortcomings of that kind of view of life. So from this, again, a macroscopic viewpoint, okay, of steady accretion, you know, looking at the usual macroscopic accretion equations, we have basically the mass flux balancing the accretion rate, the angular momentum flux balancing the turbulent viscosity. Now you have to, of course, balance the books on the magnetic field, okay? And of course, basically, there has to be a balance between the radial flow of the field in the z direction and the turbulent dissipation. And this creature, B radial star, is it's basically the product of kind of averaging. In simple terms, you could think of it as a vertical average, although it's perhaps not quite that simple. But this theory was done to allow for the possibility of self-gravitating disk, and also to allow for a possibility of deviation from purely Keplerian balance by the presence of magnetic stresses. So hence, basically, this kernel for self-gravitation. But that's not really critical, okay? But there is, again, it's a slightly more general formulation. And what comes out of this story is that for steady accretion, and who says accretion is steady, all right, that eta p over nu p has to be of order the thickness divided by the radius. And it's kind of easy to understand where this result appears from. Basically, nu t, turbulent viscosity, takes care of radial transport of angular momentum. Okay, eta t takes care of vertical diffusion b. Okay, so basically what's going on is the reason why eta t can be smaller than nu t is that all that has to happen to allow accretion to occur is if you get enough diffusion, say, across the thickness of the disk, that two of these lines of the deformed loop can meet and annihilate one another. Okay, so hence that's what sets the relevant scale ratio. So it's quite simple and physical. Okay, and quite plausible from a macroscopic standpoint. However, it's also plausible that in some sense, since nu eta p over nu t is clearly a function of the magnetic Prandtl number, and magnetic Prandtl numbers are less than one, typically in these type of disks, okay, it's plausible that nu eta p over nu t is less than one, but why the dynamic should intrinsically prefer or satisfy this ratio is an interesting question, which we have no clue about. I've got, I must say, rather little sympathy from my coworkers in raising this question. More interestingly, the question of why the microphysics should conform to macroscopic constraint is a very interesting one. Right? I think it's yet another potential question to raise about the oft-assumed assumption of stationarity.
Well, one can do a little bit more.
Yeah. I think you have your magnetic Prandtl number upside down. Huh? It's not nu t over eta.
No. I said nu t over eta t is a function of the magnetic Prandtl number. I didn't say it's
not. You say Pm is less than 1, so this ratio should be less than 1. No, it should be greater than 1.
This is the turbulent ratio. What I'm talking about, the Prandtl number, I'm referring to the collisional ratio. Okay? So in other words, and that's an important point, thank you for raising it, because at the level of the simplest sort of quasi-linear closure to compute the turbulent viscosity and turbulent resistivity, there's an inverse relation between the ratio of the turbulent quantities and the ratio of the collisional quantities, because they set the cross phase in the response in the relevant things. Okay? So this refers to the turbulent, or maybe more precisely, the total, so T, diffusivity, while the Prandtl refers, this would refer to the, you know, the microscopic collisional molecular quantity, okay? So one can go a little further and estimate mu T in the spirit of a mixing length theory in this. So in the MRI, one of the things that, again, this is another subject for a long story, is that the magnetic stress is the dominant player. And I think one of the critical features of the MRI is that generically the magnetic stress is dominant and opposite to the fluid stress. It's certainly true, as Edgar was saying, you need the curvature to get the overall direction of accretion right, but without this feature of the sign reversal, one might be in the soup. And a simple way to make an estimate of the effective transport coefficient would be to kind of explore the typical velocity that results from our radial displacement, from the balance in the induction equation, make a very crude approximation that a radial displacement times a rotation rate corresponds to a radial velocity. I think this is underneath a lot of the estimates and orderings that go on in this game. This, of course, is quite crude and is effectively setting an effective correlation time at a rotation rate. And you do all that, and you can then make an estimate of the magnetic stress and translate that by the usual recipe into an estimate of the turbulent viscosity. And I think so what you get is a complicated factor which buries all the vertical average, the vertical field thickness divided by the surface density and the rotation rate. And what that translates into, which I think will warm Ethan's heart a little bit, is that the Sikora Semyonia alpha parameter, if you like to cast things in those terms, is the order 1 over beta, which is an interesting result in the sense that while it comes out of what might be the simplest possible estimate, it's probably smaller than many of the advertised results that emerge from many of these codes, which is something that we've worried about. So then, no doubt moving, running out of time, so some points for discussion. What can we say about the momentum flux and the turbulent resistivity from mean field theory and simulation? The group of us working with Frank were really unable to find any discussion in the simulation literature of the turbulent resistivity, which is interesting given
given the obvious interest in the possible dynamo in the disks. More generally, is there any reason at all why microscopics should vindicate macroscopics? And does this mean that stationarity is simply kaput? Could one talk about stationarity in some mean or average sense, even if it's sort of violated by a localized state of fluctuations that Aker was portraying, which reminds me a little bit of a kind of self-organized criticality for the momentum profile. One of the things that comes out of that very important in star-forming disks is that you have states of high and low accretion, okay? And that just means that the accretion can be basically either fast or slow, and this is observed by a state difference in the luminosity, and this is often thought to be due to the presence of a dead zone where the magnetic field effectively is uncoupled with insufficient ionization. So this raises the question of what and the hope is that there would be some accretion continuing in such disks in the presence of the narrow surface layer, and that harkens to the discussion we were having, Helen was having earlier. I think it's quite relevant there, how to understand the MRI in such a surface layer. And then the question of what the turbulent resistivity, of course, in essentially a two-dimensional state, becomes even more heavily constrained, because you then have approximate conservation of conservation of mean square magnetic potential. So that would sort of argue for a further reduction of the effective turbulent resistivity in that state. The other thing that's interesting, of course, in such a thin layer, if you did wind up the field as heat was referring to and amplify the field a lot, presumably the field would be weaker in a higher collisionality state. You would then have just more chance for just collisional diffusion through the surface of the disk. The question of what triggers high to low transitions is one we thought about. There's sort of, in other words, how to get from one of these states to the other. The sort of the thinking is sort of collisions and slippage between the coupled and uncoupled region produces electric fields, which accelerate from superthermals, which lead to ionization, which then may lead to expansion of the coupled region. That's just a speculation. It's a very, very interesting problem. And last but not least, probably for the audience, for the interest of this crew, is how might an MRI dynamo, if such a thing exists, interact with ambient magnetization? This is this sort. So thank you.
Presumably,
I mean,
irritate
anyone, that's a disaster.
No.
Presumably, all these turbulent things emitted as we see are horribly anisotropic in the disk. So, which components are you really thinking?
These were the radial. I mean, one is interested in a radial transport of angular momentum and vertical transport of magnetic field.
Right. Okay. So it could just be that one component of one is much bigger than the other component of the other.
Yeah, it's possible, but why it should conspire to that particular ratio?
Yeah, because usually these parameters we say they are order one, so here you say they are not order one.
I think there's a very, you'll forgive me for holding my ground, but there's a very strong physical argument for why, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just says you just have to diffuse the field through the thickness of the disk while you have to accrete the matter through the radius. I mean, that's where the ratio comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's very like, it's reminiscent of the problem of what's called Taylor diffusion, in a lot of long, thin shear. You get an effective diffusion which would be in the radial direction, which is inversely proportional to the molecular diffusion in the transverse direction, simply because a patch of whatever is being diffused is drawn out a long, long way before it diffuses and evens itself out across the, the disk.
Yet the question, I mean, that one would, I think, like to, which isn't at all clear to me, is could you make a direct link between, you know, the ratio of the mean field coefficients and the ratio of the molecular coefficients, which I think you could do in sort of straightforward, shall we say, honest and believable mean field electrodynamics, and that would at least qualitatively be going the right way. And then maybe some combination of that ratio plus some anisotropy of the mode structure might actually point in the right direction. But that, however, I mean, the A, that remains to be shown, and B, why the relevant, shall we say, cross phase in the two fluxes should be so conveniently tied to the molecular diffusion coefficients is far from clear. One would think it might be the, might be more controlled by the growth rate of the instability.
Could you comment that since this problem was motivated by building yourself a star, or maybe building planets, what did you physically conclude from this paper as a consequence of this analysis?
Well, I mean, with the on the subject of conclusion of planet, for building planets, it's very promising because you, I mean, one of the things that comes out of this is that you, you can get, you basically get, in a mean sense, not, you can get sub-Keplerian rotation profiles, which is what really one of the things you deviate, one of the things you need for planet formation, and that was the driver, okay? So that that is one interesting result. On the subject of stars, I would, in some sense, this what this does is it gives you a route to explain. It's not so much building. The star is already well under construction at the stage where this is relevant, but it does give you a route for explaining the mass accretion in some of the, you know, the in these objects. And in particular, to explain, as I said, this phenomenon of accreting rather large masses without resulting in getting a ridiculous magnetic field. But the real, the bottom line is it's very interesting for planet formation.
Pat, you had this kind of idea of a, you know, you're exploiting the thinness of the disk.
Right.
So, I mean, can you say anything in a Tacker-Klein problem, for example, where you've got a very thin region one way and a very, you know, can you, is there anything you can exploit in that problem?
Well, I mean, one would, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, one, I guess the what you're politely driving at is that in the Tacker-Klein, you want to mix, you want to mix angular momentum, don't you, in the spirit of Spiegel and Zahn. At the same token, you don't want to be constrained by the magnetic field gumming up the works. I mean, what the, what is an interesting thought. I mean,
you have the density
gradient that we you can have stable stratification. Yeah, you can have stable stratification in the disk too to inhibit the MRI. But I mean, in some sense, you could play a game like this to avoid running into the problem that we did with Steve. Okay, in other words, one could ask what set of transport coefficients do you need to avoid the cancellation of the stresses, I suppose. That would be, but again, the question would be how you realize it. I don't really see how, you know, just speaking here at the, off the cuff, how you would actually realize it dynamically. So.
You had the phrase antipolar diffusion
in
one of your slides, so that's why I'm
I know.
And so that lets the field slip relative to the matter without changing its topology.
Right.
And can you comment on whether that might be, my question is it's rather a large effect.
Right.
And so that might just allow the field lines to slip back without actually
Well, the total. Remember that there's nothing quite so sophisticated as change in topology here. I mean,
they drew a little.
Oh, that's a cartoon. That's a cartoon. All right.
Worth all the money, though.
Right. Exactly. Well, the point is you need some kind of slippage, which we model as a diffusion of the field relative to the fluid. So that slippage is embodied in a magnetic diffusion coefficient, which in principle includes any turbulent resistivity, any collisional resistivity, and includes antipolar diffusion. So the constraint is on the total quantity. Okay, so in some sense, if antipolar diffusion is an important player, it still must satisfy that constraint in a steady accretion. If you believe steady accretion.
So there is, I don't know whether quantitatively it works out, but the antipolar diffusivity is proportional to the square of the magnetic field strength.
Right.
So when you have this sort of long, drawn-out field line,
back with the color.
But the point is that the aspect ratio is connected with the field, with the amount of force the field is drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be some sort of self-regulation that the antipolar diffusivity be big when you draw the field out of the structure.
Certainly. And I mean, certainly in a situation where that is important, I mean, if you want to get into the question of, shall we say, to use a pompous word, mesoscale dynamics. In other words, things like fronts and other propagation on a scale between the transport time scale, the transport scales, and the actual instability scales, that's an ideal way of looking at it. But that then would certainly manifest itself as kind of steady accretion would have to be understood only in the sense of a long time scale. Right? I mean, basically what you're saying is you would have kind of rapid, shall we say, magnetic diffusion fronts, okay, facilitating the average accretion that goes on over that range of over the disk. Is that?
Well, your idea is more
helpful. Okay.
So we could have Ethan, we could have coffee.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Let Ethan
shoot. Thank you. So I'm going to talk about some things that have bothered me about a certain class of simulations of the MRI and what they might have to do with real disks. I'm going to take a slightly different point of view than people have taken up until now. I'm primarily concerned with the MRI as an instability of the azimuthal field. And the reason I'm concentrating on that is because, of course, in a differentially rotating system, the azimuthal field tends to be the strongest field component. And it's also because disks don't seem to be very good at generating their own colloidal fields. And I'd like to think about the behavior of disks in a way that's environment independent, not to say that the environment can't produce effects on disks, but it should be convenient if at least some disks behave as though they were self-contained units. So, that being the case, if you look in a local sense at the behavior of magnetic field in a shearing flow, it's really this quantity that enters into the analysis. That is, if you have a vertical field, you can just consider the vertical component of the wave number. If you have a toroidal field, you can just consider K phi. And you can write down the dispersion relation for non-axisymmetric perturbations of a field which has both poloidal and azimuthal components. And you find that it has a sort of universal form. You don't have to worry too much about how much of one kind of field it has versus another. But there are some funny things that happen as soon as you consider a finite K5, that is to say, K5 n equal to zero, so you're looking at non-axisymmetric modes. And that's because in an accretion disk, because you have shear, different radii are going at different angular velocities, the equations don't admit to simple exponentially growing modes, whether they're plane waves or anything else. You can take a look at the linear equations and imagine putting in a localized disturbance, some particular radius, and you will find that it will grow at the rate predicted by the MRI for some large number of E-folds, but it won't grow forever. So it's sort of like the MRI. It's close enough, as far as I'm concerned. The number of E-foldings that you get is roughly the ratio of kz to k5. So you can recover the axisymmetric limit if you imagine you have kz going to infinity. Of course, it's not possible if you have even a small vertical field to literally take that limit. Now, if we look at the simulations that have been done to try to understand the saturation of MRI and just have a toroidal field, people do is they do a shearing box approximation. They try to eliminate the dependence on the environment by having zero flux conditions, some toroidal field. They let it go. And then what people seem to see is if they have a magnetic Prandtl number of about 1, you'll get some final saturated state. And if you increase the resolution, you get a saturated state that has a lower level of the total magnetic field. And roughly speaking, the more resolution you get, the weaker the final state gets. And there doesn't seem to be any particular limit to it within that range available to us. So people have taken that as a reason to doubt that the MRI is doing very much in real accretion disks. I think that's probably not the right way to look at it at all. I think what's going on is this. If you have a purely toroidal field where these simulations start out, then I can call them eddies, the individual bumps in the magnetic field, tend to have a very large kz, tend to be very shallow vertically. And the better resolution you get, the stronger that feature is. That makes sense in terms of linear theory, because the bigger you make kz, the more E-foldings you get for any particular mode, and you're not paying any penalty in terms of the growth rate. So what's happening? Well, in all these simulations, the first thing that happens is the magnetic field energy density grows roughly exponentially at the growth rate of the MRI. You know, you can put in a different physical instability. I'm forgetting the year now. I think it was 1996, one of Hawley and Babelsis' papers. They killed the Coriolis force in the system of equations. They killed the centrifugal force term in the equations. They got a shearing instability. They got the same growth for the magnetic field, and then it all died away completely after a little while. So that initial growth phase is just winding up the field, generating lots of structure. The magnetic field gets stronger and stronger. The structure gets mixed effectively over more and more of the box. Eventually, you're mixing over the whole region where you've got two separate polarities of the magnetic field as your initial condition, and then that mixing kills the large-scale field, and everything dies after that. So one thing that you can ask is, what makes the MRI different? Well, there are lots of things that make it different, but one thing I've been interested in is whether or not it's going to be the capacity of the MRI to drive a dynamo, which distinguishes it from, say, magnetized Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. So if you ask, how does the MRI drive a dynamo, if it does? And to switch gears for a second here. Some people have heard my spiel on this and some people haven't. But basically, if you consider the electromotive force parallel to the large-scale magnetic field, the conventional treatment of this divides this thing into two pieces, you all know what this other alpha is now, okay? So there's a kinetic alpha and there's a magnetic alpha piece that come in here in the usual treatment. And this thing is connected to the kinetic helicity, which is not a conserved quantity but can be non-zero and given the correct environment. This thing is connected to the current helicity, which is, J dot B for J and B fluctuating quantities. And this is related to the magnetic helicity, which for the right gauge choice for A is closely related to the current helicity. And this thing is a conserved quantity in ideal MHD and a pretty good conserved quantity in non-ideal MHD. And so although most treatments of dynamo effects concentrate on trying to drive the dynamo here, there's no particular reason why you can't drive a dynamo by making this term non-zero. And that requires basically invoking the conservation equation for the small scale averaged piece here, which looks like this. Can I erase Ellen's deathless prose?
Those are the high goals.
Okay.
You can go walk over all of the rest.
Okay. So, in order to pile up magnetic helicity and give yourself a non-zero coefficient here, it helps if you have some flux in the magnetic helicity moving it around in your system. And then this term corresponds to taking this small-scale average stuff and moving it into the large-scale field. And it's also the term that drives the dynamo at the same time because these are related physical processes. So if you have this non-zero and this saturates, this equals this, and you get a dynamo. And this flux has the generic form, you get a vertical flux. It's like looks like this. Basically, this is the total wave vector, this is the azimuthal wave vector, and this ratio will be very small if you have kz very large. And that's just because you're trying to move the magnetic flux vertically and not much is moving vertically if kz is large. And then the rest of this just is necessary to make it come out dimensionally correct.
V is a fluctuating velocity?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Let's make this delta V squared. So this is like a diffusion coefficient. And this, everything from here to here, is like the vertical diffusion coefficient. And that's, since magnetic helicity has the dimensions of magnetic field squared times length, this has the dimensions of magnetic field squared times length times velocity, as it should. Okay, so the point is, this thing is, well, in general, I should add that there's a inverse Rossby number going by, the shear times the correlation time. But for the MRI, this is about 1. So in general, there's no particular reason why the MRI can't be driving a vertical flux of magnetic helicity. In fact, if you look at quasi-linearly, it seems to do just that. And actually, if you look in the simulations of the MRI, it drives flux of magnetic helicity. So this gives you an alpha m, and because you're balancing the divergence of that flux with this, this automatically gives you a dynamo process which looks linear, but it's actually intrinsically nonlinear. And the growth rate that you get when you work through all of this and you have this process generating radial magnetic field and then shear generating as a mutual field, is that you get a growth rate which is like V over the vertical size of your magnetic domain times K theta over K. So,
how do you handle losses of felicity through the top and bottom of the disk? In other words, the obvious thing would be just diffuse it out of the disk on the short distance.
That's right. No, you can make a toy model of how this works by just having a box. And when you look at the box, what you see is that a simple model dynamo works by just having a magnetic helicity current which goes straight up through the box. Sometimes it's carried in little jh as a magnetic helicity flux associated with fluctuations. Sometimes it's carried in the magnetic field structures on large scales. And you can either set your box so that the box is ejecting large-scale magnetic helicity or small-scale magnetic helicity. Doesn't really matter which you decide. The energy that it takes for the accretion disk to eject magnetic helicity is pretty small. So you could, store the magnetic helicity in the box, but that just makes the model more complicated. I don't think it turns anything off.
I'm not sure about that point. Because I think in the solar dynamo, this is actually one of the key questions we are wondering, is what is the role of the magnetic helicity in the solar dynamo?
Well, normally when people talk about the magnetic helicity poisoning the dynamo process, what they mean in particular is that this term balances this term and turns the whole thing off. But if what you're doing is actually moving the magnetic helicity around in order to generate an electromotive force, then there's no poisoning implied.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that if your boundary condition, I agree with that, are such that you don't have magnetic helicity flux, then you don't really, you will have to have a compensation between your large-scale magnetic helicity and your small-scale magnetic helicity, and that's unclear what that will result into.
Somewhere in the box, somewhere in the box, you have to make the accounting balance out. But since in this model, if you want to, on one half of your box, you're accumulating positive magnetic helicity on large scales, and the other half of the box, you're accumulating negative magnetic helicity on large scales, you still have zero magnetic helicity overall, and it's not clear that the process needs an escape hatch, although the simple model that I have does have one, and maybe you do. Anyhow, no swearing, I'm being recorded for posterity. So the point here is that the dynamo gets weaker as KZ becomes large. And if the natural consequence of increasing your resolution is that you make flatter and flatter modes, then what that tells you is that you're also going to get a weaker and weaker dynamo as you increase your resolution. And there's no obvious end to this process. You're never going to win by increasing the resolution. You're not going to arrive at some final state where everything looks like you're getting a unique number. Now, I don't want to go on about this. But I want to say a couple more words anyhow. Especially now that Steve has tried to goad me.
He's trying to turn you off.
He was trying to turn me off, but I know in his heart he wanted me to go on. You can make a simple model of balancing this dynamo with a turbulent diffusion process that's intermittent, driven by the growing strength of the magnetic field. And you find that you predict that if you increase the resolution, your magnetic field energy will drop, your alpha will drop. If you keep the resolution fixed, but you increase the pressure, then because of the feedback to the Courant condition and therefore the numerical viscosity, as the pressure goes up, the dynamo seems to get more effective, which is something that Sano saw in his paper. I don't think that was on the reference list. But it
it's a bizarre result that he explained by having something to do with reconnection, which I don't believe. In real disks, none of this matters. Real disks have vertical structure. They have vertical gravity. There's no possibility of making infinitely thin eddies. One simple effect that you get is that when you have some sort of magnetic instability making one of these eddies, then you're going to get density fluctuations. Delta rho over rho is like the Alfvén speed, over the sound speed squared. And in the course of one eddy turnover time, you have your vertical gravity like so. So this is your buoyant acceleration. And you get the height that a little blob will go up by multiplying by the correlation time squared, which kills this. And you find that if you're right at the midplane, there really is no unique vertical scale given to you by magnetic buoyancy. But anywhere else in the disk, there is. And that means that you can't keep increasing KZ forever. But it also means that you can't get any insight into how the dynamo behaves by looking at accretion disk models with no vertical gravity.
Okay, on that bombshell. Comments, was it your favorite? You have to be careful using something that looks like alpha K minus alpha M and then driving it all in alpha M. I mean, that formula, as I understand it, means Anik's formula. So she can explain where it comes from.
You can interpret for her, even though she's wrong.
My interpretation of that formula is. Not mine. I mean, my understanding of it, though, is that it comes about from an MHD state. If you have a non-linear MHD state, which might be the saturation of a small-scale dynamo, say, then you can work out two contributions to the EMF, which you can designate as alpha K and alpha M. But then you've already got a saturated MHD state. Then you have to ask the question, what does getting an alpha on top of that mean? You said, people use it. I mean, how it's used is as a saturation mechanism for the alpha effect, where the J and the B are the evolving magnetic fields, but that's not really how it should be used. So I would say that, I have problems with that. And I have all kinds of problems with J being A and helicity being conserved, etc., etc., but I have problems right at the outset with that, actually.
Okay, well, that's... Right. I know there's a long literature on this. I'm taking the point of view that it's legitimate to estimate V cross B by taking the time derivative of the whole expression and multiplying by tau.
Well, that is a really, really dangerous thing to do, I would say. You can prove 1 equals 2 by that, because all you do is take derivatives and put them like... Yeah, you start with U cross B and you differentiate it and you get D by the T of U cross B is DT U cross B plus U cross DTB, and then all the D by DTs become 1 over tors. So you get 1 over tor U cross B is U cross B over tor plus U cross B over tor. So that's good. So that's 2 equals 1. So that's a kind of...
No, come on.
No, it's not just being facetious. That's what you prove when you do that. That's not a rigorous thing to do.
I don't know a rigorous way to estimate the cross field. I'll concede that right away.
But I guess you don't need that alpha M interpretation, because you are just saying that the electromotive force of B is divergence of some flux, right? I mean,
why do
you need to talk about alpha M?
Well, I was putting it in there because that's how the alpha suppression works.
If that is better for the suppose you don't want to talk about alpha M, but you just ask what that equation means.
Stick to the right hand side of this
equation.
And then say that electromotive force is being driven by divergence of a flux. Maybe that's, I don't know. That helps. Doesn't help.
Assuming that the divergence of a flux is there.
Yeah, assuming that the divergence.
Otherwise, you're stuck with resisted dissipation.
Yes, of course. Of course.
Is Pat and Allen?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of divergence of the flux and is it there, I mean, I'm an old-fashioned sort. I like to think in terms of the same speech as our discussion yesterday. Great, you know, relating fluxes to coefficients times gradients and you know, diffusion, convection, etc. And I look at that's a flux in the z direction, and the only thing that looks remotely like a gradient there is omega, which presumably is dv dr. So how are you getting a vertical flux?
The flux is aligned with the shear. I mean, it's in the direction of the vector direction of the shear.
No, but
there's a cross section.
Yeah, but there's got to be some.
There's cross products.
There's cross products. Yeah.
All right. Ellen, okay.
So I just wanted to get it straight. Is it your conjecture that if you solve the equations with dissipation coefficients, with resistivity, and with viscosity, but you did a very good job, so your computation is fully resolved, that there would be no time?
I think that's right. I think that you would end up driving at such high KZ that you would kill, you would progressively kill the magnetic field, the resistive effects.
But this is sufficiently small
resistivity. I mean, it's sufficiently large resistivity. Actually, I have no intuition at all. And Fausto was going to talk about this, so maybe I should keep my mouth shut.
Yeah. Not that that seems like it.
My conjecture is that the dynamo works best if the vertical wavelength is significant.
Okay, so let's thank Ethan again. Fausto is now going to tell us about dynamo. I mean, this is a dynamo program, so and you're going to use the thing. You're going to use your laptop.
I can just move it over there. If you believe me when I draw a diagram, then I need the screen. Okay, so what I want to address is a relatively straightforward issue, which is. And I want to address it within the framework of the shearing box approximation, and I want to address it within the framework of numerical simulation. So I don't want to go into the issue of one, has the MRI got anything to do with accretion disks? That is not what I want to talk about. Nor do I want to talk about the diatribe of is the MRI as described by numerical simulation in shearing box approximation relevant to a disk? All I want to do is say, a lot of what we know about the MRI is from numerical simulations in shearing boxes. So these are Cartesian, periodic, 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 where in the radial direction they're sheared. Okay? So that's what they look like. And the question I want to address can be formulated as such. The numerical studies of the MRI started in the early 90s with this famous paper by Baumbus and Hollies. And it continued throughout the 90s and the noughties. And so there's 15 years worth of numerical simulation of this stuff. And in 2007, Papaloisiou and Fromange, or the other way around, wrote two papers back to back. And the first paper, what they did was a convergent study of...
Plug-in?
I'm sorry?
Did you plug your computer?
Yeah, it's okay. I will need it eventually. How do I plug it in?
This is all being recorded.
Okay. So these guys in 2007 decided that it was about time somebody did a convergence study to see if these simulations converged. Now, why did they do that? Because the codes that everybody had been using for 15 years are things called essentially under-resolved codes. So these are codes that they're Euler solvers. They have no they have no explicit dissipation. Okay? That doesn't mean they don't have dissipation. Of course they have dissipation. They are very dissipative, in fact, but the dissipation is numerical. So one way to think about these codes is that in some sense, they have a dissipation that depends on the resolution. The higher the resolution, the less the dissipation. In the other sense, they are objects that have a magnetic Prandtl number close to 1. Maybe a little bit bigger, who knows, it's hard to say, but close to 1. So, Fromange and Papaloisiou, what they did...
Fromage. 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 What they did,
Sébastien Froment.
They did, a series of simulations, and this is where things get interesting. So the series of simulations they did was they run this thing with resolution of 64 by 64 by something else, like 128. But let's just say 64 by 64, 128 by 128, 256 by 256. Okay, this is what they did. The interesting thing is that until that time, the typical simulation that had been run for 15 years was about 64 by 64. Okay? So there's an enormous amount of stuff, which is 64 by 64. In 2007, finally somebody looks at 64 by 64, 128, 128, 256, 256, and they find that every time they increase the resolution, this alpha, alpha SS, the thing that everybody's interested in, which is, let's say, the efficiency with which you transport angular momentum, keeps going down. Okay? So they conclude that there's a problem, because they think, what? So if we go to infinite resolution, this thing gets infinitely small. So in the second paper, they say, okay, let's put in explicit numerical diffusion. Okay, so they put it in, explicit diffusion that is bigger than the numerical one, so they can actually have a sensible Reynolds number, magnetic Reynolds number, and they run a series of calculations, and this time they can vary the magnetic Prandtl number. Okay, so they do that, and what they find is the following statement that can be summarized by one picture that I have. Actually, I can actually just show you the picture. Okay, let me show you the picture that summarizes what these guys.
Light.
Okay, so, I am actually, so. Okay, so this is a summary of their calculations. This is from their paper. And so the thing that they noticed is that, okay, these calculations, I'm afraid for this talk, you really have to pay attention to the resolution because it's all to do with this stuff. So these are all calculations which are 128 by 128 by something else. Okay, but 128, 128. So what they found is that yes and no corresponds to cases where yes, it means there is a dynamo. The magnetic field regenerates in this thing. This turbulence lasts forever. No, it means it decays. These are all cases that have no mean flux. So they can't decay to zero magnetic field. Okay?
MRI, not dynamo.
I'm sorry?
There is MRI, not dynamo.
Yes, but you need a dynamo to regenerate the field. They have no mean flux. So if you say the MRI is not a dynamo, you start initially, they decay. So the nodes correspond to decay, 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 decay. Yes, 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 yes means things that will stay there forever. Okay? Notice that they're all this is Reynolds number, Reynolds number, magnetic Reynolds number. They're all that side, which means they only can get this thing to work if the magnetic Prandtl number is bigger than 1. Okay? So this is what they conclude. They conclude this based on numerical simulations of 128 by 128 by something or other, okay? It's important that we remember this. And that leads them to this cartoon, which you can read. It says, you know, given our present computational things, we can't be sure that this is what is going on, but this is the picture. So the important picture that they're saying, look, there is a critical magnetic Prandtl number below which it doesn't matter what you do, you can't get this thing to work, okay? So the alternative is that this thing asymptotes to zero, which is there is no such thing. Okay? So that is what I want to discuss. And it's not even that I want to discuss and argue that there is or there isn't. I just want to outline to you, from the point of view of a numerical analyst, what it takes to address the question. Okay? So this is what I want to do. I'm not saying that it's true or that it's false, but my conclusion is that
No.
What?
Do your own work. These are the big questions
you
have to hear.
Every 4 seconds, they take a picture of the blackboard. So it's all recorded.
But not for our memory. I want to hear these big questions. But maybe Ellen will...
Every 4 seconds, just take a picture of your memory. Okay, so it turns out that the crucial thing is that what we need to describe here is dynamo action in a turbulent flow. Okay? Turbulence is crucial for this discussion. So we need some machinery to describe turbulence, a minimal machinery. The minimal machinery that I need is that I'm going to have to define these things, which are the structure functions. So these are the sort of statistics of velocity differences. Okay, so take the velocity sort of here plus little displacement, subtract the velocity here, dotted into sort of the unit vector along the displacement, absolute value, square it, take the ensemble average of that thing. Now this is the thing that goes as the displacement to some power that I'm going to call alpha, because we haven't got enough alphas as it
there
is.
There are other Greek letters.
Yeah, but none of them have the same flair, okay? Okay, so this of course assumes that I have a process that is homogeneous, isotropic, all sorts of things, but you know, it's a very convenient from the point of view of dynamo to use this quantity here to describe turbulence. It's called the roughness exponent or the Holder exponent or whatever. It just goes to say that if you're used to this representation for this energy spectrum with k to the minus p, then p is just the 1 plus 2 alpha. So if you give me alpha, I give you the spectrum. If you give me the spectrum, I give you alpha. Okay? Now, the important thing about these things is that once I've got this thing, it's a bit like saying if alpha is equal to 1, I have a smooth function. Okay? If alpha is less than 1, it's rough. Rough here means that in the limit it will not have a derivative. Okay? So it wiggles a lot. And the one you're familiar with is alpha equal 1/3, which is Kolmogorov 41. So that's Kolmogorov turbulence. All right? Now, why this thing is useful, you'll see in a moment, but let me say a few other things. If I want to look at the scale at which diffusion operates, it works like this. This is the integral scale. This has something to do with my magnetic Reynolds number, and it comes in with this power, alpha plus 1. Okay? So I have a corresponding one for viscosity, L0 Rm to the minus 1 over alpha plus 1. Notice that if you turn it around a little bit and you write L0 over delta eta, okay, then this thing is something that goes Rm to the 1 over alpha plus 1. This one is Re. Thank you. So this tells you something useful if you think about it. Suppose you have a smooth flow, then this is a half. Okay? Rm to the 1 half. This is the dimension of your domain in units of your diffusivity scale. Okay? So it tells you how many boundary layers you need to stack in a row to resolve this particular Reynolds. The bigger the Reynolds number, the more you need. The bigger your physical domain. If alpha is 1/3, this comes in with a power of 3/4, which is bigger than a half. So conclusion, numerically speaking, it's much harder to describe a turbulent process than a laminar one with the same Reynolds number. Okay? Simple fact of life, but true. All right? Finally, if you take the ratio of those two things, right, you take delta eta over delta nu, right? So this is the thickness of one type of boundary layer as opposed to the thickness of the other one. You just get the ratio of those two things. So it's going to be Rm over Re to the minus 1 over alpha plus 1. This is Pm. It's the magnetic Prandtl number. Okay? So you can think of the magnetic Prandtl number as a distance in K-space between the boundary layers. Notice that everything comes in with this alpha in it. So everything I do, it's different if I'm dealing with laminar flows or rough velocities, okay? So given all of that, let me go to the next picture, which is this one. So what is this? This is this quantity here that I've just defined, the structure function, second order structure function, computed for an actual numerical simulation of the MRI with a mean field. So this one is a weak mean field. So no issue of whether it's a dynamo or not, because you'll see why not. But this is what you measure, and this one was done with 512 grid points. Okay, so those were all 128, 512. This is what these structure functions look like. Now, if you have a smooth function, which you hope to have, then the second order structure function better go as L squared for small l, because that's the definition of a continuous smooth function. All right? So down here, these things always have to go as, you know, L squared. And then they do something else. The something else depends on the turbulent. If it's Kolmogorov, this is going to be two-thirds. Otherwise, it's going to be something else. All right? Now, the important thing is that this is one grid point. This is two, this is three, this is four, this is five. Okay? So this tells you that over about five grid points, this is a code that has no explicit dissipation. This is like, this is called Pluto, but it's just like Zeus or Athena or PPM or whatever you like. So even if you have no explicit dissipation, the numerical dissipation will smooth out any function you give it on a scale of about four, five, six grid points. So this is the minimum that you need to represent a gradient. Less than that number of points, computers cannot understand that you're talking about gradients, okay? Notice that this, which is about 50 delta x up here, is where this thing homes onto what you would call the inertial range. So up here, on these scales of 50 grid points, is where a numerical scheme begins to understand the representation of a random function that is singular. Okay, so this is telling you that if you're interested in smooth things, you may just need five grid points to represent them. But if you want to represent a random thing, you need at least 10 times the resolution. Okay? So what are we talking about here? What we're talking about is the following question. I want to address the issue of dynamo action at small magnetic Prandtl numbers. Small magnetic Prandtl numbers, it means that I've got very little viscosity and a ton of magnetic diffusivity, which means that if I were to draw the equivalent curve for the magnetic field, it would be displaced relative to this one to the right. Okay? It would mean that the magnetic boundary layers of the magnetic field were sitting somewhere in the inertial range of the velocity. Okay? That's pretty obvious. So, first of all, you can make immediately some statements. This is 50 grid points in a periodic domain, which means this curve that doesn't look anything like symmetric has to be symmetric. It doesn't look symmetric because this is a logarithmic scale. But it is a symmetric scale. So this point and this point have to be the same, and all of that side of the curve has to be the same as this side of the curve, okay? So really, this curve only means anything for half your grid points, because in a periodic domain, when you go for more than half the domain, you start wrapping around the other side. You're actually not increasing the length, you're decreasing it because you're coming back from behind. So immediately you can say that if all you have is 128 points, you're about here. And this thing drops dead. It's not even clear that you can represent a random function of this type with 128 points, okay? And the question you're addressing is what would happen if you had this thing for the magnetic field sitting right here. Okay? So if you want to translate in terms of point, it's a bit like saying, I want this to be sitting in the inertial range, which means my boundary layers for the magnetic fields are 50 grid points. And then I have to have room to maneuver to build up the Reynolds number, because it's not, I can't drive a dynamo at a magnetic Reynolds number of 1. I need to drive a dynamo at a magnetic Reynolds number that is bigger than 1. Okay? But it just takes me 50 grid points just to put something in here. Okay? Other important thing to notice. How do I do that? I do that by decreasing the magnetic Prandtl number. But notice that once I've decreased it enough that this boundary layer gets here, decreasing it further doesn't make any difference. Why not? Because I'm going to argue in a second that the only thing that a dynamo cares about, unless you have Courier structure or stuff like that, is this alpha. It's the roughness of the velocity. Okay? So let me explain very quickly what this is, because Steve is standing up, which means I've run out of time. So what this is okay, this is I know this is a crazy scale that starts at 2 and goes down to 1.3. The reason it's like this is because going that way, you're increasing the roughness of the velocity. So this is a smooth velocity. This is Kolmogorov at 1.33. This is 1 plus alpha, okay? What this crazy curve is, for a specific solvable model of a dynamo, which I'm not going to go into, but it's an actual exact model of a dynamo, it says that if this is the kind of domain size measured in units of the boundary layers that you need to get dynamo action for a smooth flow, this is the domain size that you need if the roughness exponent is that of a Kolmogorov flow. All right? So if you remember, we said you need at least 5 or 6 points to represent the gradient. So this thing says, let's say it's 4. It says, well, if you're a smooth flow, you may be able to get away, you know, 4 times, so 20 points, and you may be able to get your dynamo to work, maybe. But that's the kind of number that you need. On the other hand, you need at least 30 diffusive boundary layers to get the same thing to work with a rough velocity. Furthermore, this thing is going up like crazy. So if, God forbid, my turbulence is even rougher than Kolmogorov, I really need a heck of a lot of resolution to do it. However, it only depends on alpha. It doesn't depend on anything else. So let me just go back for a second so we can conclude. What does that thing say? If really this thing is going rough, I need to take this thing, which is about 50 grid points, which is the minimum I need to represent a random function. And on that, I need to build something that is 30 times my diffusive boundary layers if the roughness is a third. So I need 50 times 30, 1500 grid points to get this thing to have the right magnetic Reynolds number that it needs to be a dynamo. Okay? That's for a marginal dynamo. So if I want to drive it a little harder, go for 3,000 points, okay? And then the thing it says, then it doesn't matter, because once you've excited it, making the magnetic Prandtl even smaller really is not going to make any difference at all, because you've excited and you're done. So then, now you know everything, plonk it into this thing and say, well, this is about 5 delta x, this is about 50 delta x. So this thing is going to level off at about, you know, when the ratio is 10, 55, 10, put everything in here. This tells you what is the magnetic Prandtl number that you need if your roughness is Kolmogorov-like to get the thing in here. So if you do that, you get 0.05, more or less. Okay? So the prediction that one can make, even before you start, are the following. First of all, things are going to get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse until you get to a magnetic Prandtl number of 0.05, and thereafter it's not going to make any difference what you do. But 0.05 is a hell of a small magnetic Prandtl number. And the kind of resolution that you need to make sure that your numerics is all kosher and is representing everything the way it should is of the order of, you know, a few thousand. Okay? So this is it. Those who are interested in this program have their challenge. You want to answer this question, you want to run numerical simulation and inform you what's going on, you're into the 3,000-4,000 cube class of simulation. Anything smaller than that, you're on the wrong regime, you're dealing with smooth functions, you have scaling behavior that has got nothing to do with turbulence, and you just, you know, you shouldn't say anything sensible because you're not. Thank you.
Yeah, can you make the connection with the other work? So they were by 128.
Okay, so what they were doing, you know, you're over here and your dynamo works fine. Why does it work fine? You're dealing with smooth functions, because if you have 64 points, that's all you can represent. Then you increase it a little bit. Of course, your Reynolds number goes up because this is a code that has got, you know, unresolved things. So your velocity begins to crinkle up and your dynamo, of course, begins to switch off because you don't have the increasing magnetic Reynolds number that you need to get this thing to come back. And then they increase again, and this thing dies on you even more because you're not climbing up that curve that you need. Well, that's fine, but the problem is that they're making an astrophysical statement, you know, like, oh, you cannot have dynamo in an accretion disk, you know, with a magnetic Prandtl number of 10 to the minus 5, 6, or 7. You think? Right, well, I mean, you can put some bounds. You think if this thing has a Reynolds number 10 to the 12, then it will have a magnetic Reynolds number 10 to the 5, which is probably enough to drive a dynamo. But you can't do it numerically. Or you can, but that's not what these guys do. You're not going to do it with 64 cube, not even with 128 cube. I mean, you know.
But you did the computation with the...
I did a computation that was 700 cube, and all of us died, and our families divorced us, and we never want to do it again. So, and it's not even close to where we want to be. So ours had a magnetic Prandtl number of a half. And it was a dynamo.
It was only 700 cube. I thought you were...
700 cube.
Only 700.
No, it's not being 700.
And these were spectral elements. They weren't even spectral.
It was. You used 48,000 CPUs.
64,000 CPUs.
And only 700 cube.
There's
something strange here. I thought you were doing 2,000 cube.
Here, look, I'll show it to you. Okay.
And see. While you show, Yuri has a question, if you can answer.
Well, is this a problem of sufficient urgency to address it?
I don't know. I don't think I want to be the one that addresses it. I mean, as I say, this was 700 cubic killed us all, and we're still recovering. And this wasn't even a shearing box. This was a full cylinder. So this is really, you know, not what you need. You want to take all the resolution and put it all in a tiny little box. But that's what it takes. I mean, that's what it's going to take. Several thousand cube.
But then is there any debate about whether that thing would be a self-sustaining dynamo?
Most of us would say, until someone comes with a reason why it shouldn't be, we can only assume that it is. But, I mean, it's one of those. Should you prove that things are or that things are not?
Okay. So are we to conclude that there is still room for theorists in this field?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, all of this, I didn't solve anything. I mean, until now, there's nothing. I mean, the Kazantsev equation, 1968, it's analytic.
That's an important
point. Let's go back to the physics of that. I mean, if you believe there is a magnetic field, why should... I mean, do you need to drive the dynamo if you have a threading field through the star and the interstellar medium around the star and the accretion disk, then you have a flux through the system and then
then you don't care. But I mean, as I said at the beginning, I want to discuss this thing without the framework of the shearing box approximation and that statement. Because otherwise, then people start saying, what about if you have partial ionization? What about if you have grain dust? You know, what about if you have this, that? I don't know. I just like...
And tell me, why do you need 64,000 CPUs to do a 7 cube simulation?
700.
700, yeah, 700. I don't understand that.
Is it Cartesian geometry?
No, it's this thing. Spectral elements.
So together you can get like 3,000 or 4,000 cube, but it with periodic Fourier or something like that.
Yeah, it's this thing. This is the experiment that Hantel is doing. This is exactly the geometry of, you know, it's like 7 centimeters, whatever, 21 centimeters, 28 centimeters, same rotation rate, same everything.
Yeah. How long did you run it?
I don't know, 500,000 hours?
I mean, you have what? I mean, in this 100,000 CPU class, you should start speaking of 10 million hours, 15 million hours.
Yes, 80 million hours. Yes,
so
exactly.
I'm surprised. I thought you were doing a much bigger simulation with this big computer. I mean,
no, I'm just saying what it takes. The problem is not doing the simulation. The problem is then you don't know where to put the output.
Yeah, we need to discuss that together. Yeah.
No, because I don't want to do the simulation.
Okay, so we're going to pass on to Basil again. We're going to finish with David. He's going to use the board. Okay, so we'll leave this on then.
Oops.
You know, I can always reconstruct your first question.
Okay, I'll be brief, being speaker number N in a long afternoon. And I'm not going to talk about dynamos, even though it's a dynamo session. I'm not going to talk about large numerical simulations either. So I'm just going to say a little, really, about a model we've been looking at. And we are these guys. It's a Leeds-Cambridge collaboration. Franco-British collaboration, where nearly all the work was done by the French element. And there are two papers out. I think Steve put them on the wiki. And we came into this, at least three of us, I think it's fair to say, knew precious little about accretion disks. And we were reading all of these shearing box things. And our view was that there was probably things that could be done in a cleaner setting. And Edgar touched on some of these things. So in particular, we were not that enamored with the shearing box approximation. It is, it's local, it has strange boundary conditions, of course. So the two questions we wanted to look at were, could we have a global model? And could we have a global model that wasn't just Taylor-Couette? I mean, you can, of course, you can look at what essentially is the experiment, a Taylor-Couette flow with rigid boundaries. Could you have a global model with an inflow? So that's what we've looked at. And this paper is the setup of the model and the linear theory. And this one has some nonlinear solutions. So they're not turbulent. I mean, they clearly have the... how the MRI saturate, they're not dynamos or anything. All I'm going to talk about today is just the model that we've set up, and if you're interested, the papers are there.
And so the inflow refers to radial flow.
Yes. So, sure. Yeah. So what we wanted to look at, radial inflow. In the simplest model, in the simplest global model we could think of. Okay. So we looked for. So what we have is a steady state. Okay, to begin with. Okay. So our steady state has a radial velocity and an azimuthal velocity. Okay. So there's the R momentum equation, which needn't concern us right now. And we sit in a applied maths department, so we can make all kinds of assumptions. So, first of all, we assumed it was incompressible. Okay? So if it's incompressible, then we have d by dr of rur equals 0. Okay? So that determined our radial flow. Okay. So the radial flow looks like something which actually we call alpha over r. Yeah.
Thank you.
What else? What else could we have called it, right? Well, we didn't. It's not a dynamo, and this paper was so far from accretion disk. There's no dynamos, and there's no other alpha. So this was perfectly sensible notation. Then you can ask, what is u phi in this? Okay, you might say this is kind of arguing it backwards, but within this assumption, this is how you argue it. Okay, so there's the phi momentum equation. It's steady. Okay, in the basic state. So the phi momentum equation says u r u phi by dr plus u r u phi over r is all the viscous stuff. Okay, and the viscous stuff. 1 over r d by dr of r u phi by dr donc minus u phi over r squared. So in the usual Taylor-Couette,
all you have, of course, is this one. And this tells you that U phi looks like R plus 1 over R, the standard couette between rotating cylinders. Okay, but we don't have that. We have an inflow. Okay. Given by that. So you just plonk that into there, and of course it's a homogeneous equation, so it's easy to solve. So U phi looks like a power function, looks like R to some power. So U phi looks like whatever we called it, theta times R to 1 plus alpha over nu. Okay. Plus gamma over R. Unless something holds, in which case there's a logarithmic solution. But in general, that's what U phi looks like. Okay. And from the R momentum equation, which I haven't written down, that essentially just tells you the pressure. Okay, because you know U R and you know U phi and you know the gravitational potential. So it tells you the pressure. Okay, and in these kind of incompressible models, you don't have to be Keplerian. That's kind of at your disposal. Here. Okay, so you can choose alpha to be Keplerian.
There's more gravity around this thing.
Well, there is and there isn't. Okay. If we write down the R momentum equation, we can write it down with the gradient of a gravitational potential. Okay, and it looks like grad of 1 over R. But we also have a grad pressure. So within the assumptions of the model, it's all really in the pressure. So it's kind of funny like that. Okay. Well, that's it. So that was, okay, so that's a basic state. Then, of course, you run into all kinds of problems, which essentially is what I'm going to talk about in the last 5 minutes, which is what do you do for boundary conditions? You try and be realistic, we were pseudo-realistic, by having an inflow. Then you have to say, what boundary conditions can we have on this model? Okay, and of course, there's the usual thing that you do is, in experiments, for example, you have no radial flow, of course, and that's exactly what we don't want. So what we went for, and there's a lot of choice in this, is, okay, and it's the U phi conditions that we really bothered about. We chose not to impose an R, a boundary condition on UR, okay, because we thought, and we still think, I think, that in the nonlinear evolution, we would like it to evolve to accrete as it wanted to. We didn't want to artificially constrain the radial flow by saying it should be something at the boundaries. So we put no condition on UR, okay, but two conditions. So we're missing one. So we have two conditions on U phi, okay. That's what we did at first. We chose a kind of mixed condition relating du phi by dr to u phi to force Keplerian flow, and we also fixed u phi. Okay. And then you have boundary conditions on the other guys, but they're not so important. Okay. Then you can do the linear stability analysis, which is of this thing. Okay. And it's messy. Of course, you have to do it numerically, and it's messy. The fact that you don't have a boundary condition on UR makes it much more tricky than when you do. So this is these are the basic modes. Okay, there is one particular case where if you don't have diffusion and you assume axisymmetry, then you can't have an inflow. Okay, that's the only case you cannot have an inflow. If you're ideal but non-axisymmetric, or non-ideal, either axisymmetric or non-axisymmetric, you have to have an inflow in the basic state. Okay, but the equations forbid that when you're both ideal and axisymmetric. So this is the standard MRI mode. Okay, so this is axisymmetric ideal. Okay, so it's not really the kind of comparison. It comes up in our model, but it doesn't have the features of our model that we were bothered about. Okay, and this kind of addresses Keith's point, but I think Keith's gone. So, were he here, this would address his point, but since he's gone.
Will you read for us? I mean,
it's about B and K, so it's the field strength against the wave number. These are contours of growth rate, sorry. So then you say, okay, what happens to if we now allow an inflow? Those modes carry through, okay, which is kind of what we thought. There must be modifications to these dissipative modes, and here they are. And if that were the story, then that would be the story. And the difficulty we faced is that there is another set of modes, okay, which are completely different to these what we call body modes, the standard MRI modes, which are these things, which are we call wall modes. They're peaked at the inner boundary. So this is our radius from 1 to 2, our disk, if you like. So this is the radial velocity here. So there are these modes, and these have a much bigger growth rate than the body modes. Okay. So the problem we had is that, you know, we think we're being more realistic. We'll have an inflow in the basic state, and we come up with a completely new mode with a much bigger growth rate, because the MRI mode, of course, there is a maximum that it can be. This exceeds that, okay. So there's a problem if you try and do this, that you get these. So this is with fixing the azimuthal flow on the boundary. So what we looked at, so there's a question of what are these modes, okay? Where do they come from? Which actually you don't need a cylinder to address them in. It's quite a nice linear stability problem. You can just do it in Cartesians. You can just look at the shear flow with a magnetic field with funny boundary conditions. Okay, the standard thing you do in shear flows, of course, is to impose impermeable boundaries on top. If you don't do that, and you impose, for the sake of argument, no transverse flow, no tangential flow, then you can show that you can bring in energy from outside to drive an instability. And this is, details don't matter, this is just to show that you can do it in a Cartesian geometry. So as soon as you start having a global model, but a model with inflow, you have to be careful what you do for the boundary conditions. So we looked at a number of boundary conditions, and what we found, what we went for in the end, was imposing the pressure on the outer boundary, which worked in the sense that it suppressed the growth rate to a level comparable with the MRI growth rate. So it's clearly not the only thing we could have done. So I think the only message that I would say is that if you try and be even remotely more realistic in having inflows through your disk, you have to be very careful with your boundary conditions, because there are a whole family of different kinds of instabilities. Okay, I'll stop there.
Comments? Questions?
Everyone's exhausted.
Does this provide you with some opinions about shearing boxes in Keplerian local domains?
I don't know, because you can't really compare what we did with shearing boxes, because the global modes. I mean, we didn't like the shearing boxes. It's a funny approximation. I mean, we've heard more about it today anyway. We didn't like it from the off. So we went for this, so we were interested in global modes.
But your global mode is in the sense that you're an equatorial ring or something.
Yeah. We're not, sorry, but you shouldn't think of this as the whole disk. Yeah, you should think of this as a kind of pineapple segment. Pineapple ring in the middle.
Well, I think there are problems in astrophysics with mass supply is given. And I think your idea of seeing at what rate the system wants to accrue is interesting. But I think there are cases where Mercury is steady state, it has to increase its rate, has to accrete its rate.
I mean, I mean, we could do that as well. I mean, you fix the radial mass flux, you mean? Yeah.
Well, there's also other relativistic things going on, like beaming engines.
So, I think of relativity, I was thinking of even, mass transfer.
We could put a beaming engine in.
Even
have
a beaming engine available.
No. just beaming physicists, that might be more dangerous.
I'd like to ask, since we all were motivated by some of the questions that Ellen really put up, including her first one that has disappeared, maybe turn the board lights on. there were a sensible set of questions. Are there some impressions relative to those? If it's a group discussion.
In local domains that don't happen in that global calculation. That happens.
How does it think about it? Can I just comment on that? Sure. I generally agree with this statement, but I think if you want to understand the saturation mechanisms of the instability, then these local approximation to what's going on are actually a very good model of what might happen. If you really want to understand whether the reasoning will say viscosity and things like this, to actually reach
something that's smaller than that.
I think it's very useful to have some relatively simple, at least not actually simple situation, but they are simpler than the global problem.
Right.
And so I think if you can't understand the saturation problem in that local regime, I don't think you're likely to figure it out for the whole this.
You have to be very careful because there are some things that happen in local.
Absolutely. There will be some
differences. There's some guy who wrote that paper on
local. Yeah, there's to think about it, there are some systems that, you can do exactly the same thing for convection that you can do for disks. And you can say, I want to do convection in a triple periodic domain that is periodic in the vertical. They get some really funky results that don't seem to be very good representation of putting a little box in the middle of a convective layer that that has boundaries no matter how remote. And so convection, no matter how you slice it, always knows where the boundaries are. Because it always has a finite Reynolds, Rayleigh number, and the Nusselt number scales some power of that. So you can put them as big as you want, but those finite. So coming in and saying they're infinite means what? I don't know, you have infinite not so much. I don't know. So convection, for instance, if you try the trick, doesn't work very well. Mm. Other than to say, it goes to an adiabatic state and now you know what you've done. But if you take a little representation and put it adiabatic, then it doesn't convect. So
it's a bit weird.
Yeah, but convection is
it's driven through the boundary.
Not only through the core, but also through the boundary.
But
somehow here you have to put in the
angular
momentum.
As you're saying, maybe gravity or maybe the boundary. I think one of the things that seems to be that's striking to me, I certainly maybe for very simple reasons would agree that if you can't understand the local problem, you're a dead duck. But, basically here there are three classes of timescales, right? There's the timescales of the local problem, there's the timescales of the accretion rate, of the accretion process, which is the global transport timescales, and then, for lack of anything better, then there are mesoscale timescales, which would involve perhaps the interaction of a few sort of local modes on which the profiles flop around and deviate from stationarity and so forth. And I notice this group
basically ignores two of the three classes of timescales. And it might be particularly, I think that the mesoscales seem to be emerging as an interesting thing to think about. And, you know, where theorists could be useful too, you know, because you'd be working basically with envelope equations and maybe kind of strategies a la reaction diffusion modeling and so forth.
Well, bear in mind that when people were doing alpha disks, except that they still are, they also have a dynamical time scale, which is like the MRI time scale. Right. They have the accretion time scale, of course, it's the same thing. And they have the thermal equilibration time scale, which is probably pretty much like the dynamo time scale in these problems, or whatever you want to call it. So I don't think that looking at this as an MRI has added a time scale so much as it's added physics to the mesoscale and to the fastest things. And if you want to explore the mesoscale, you probably have to put it in more realistic physics.
Yeah, but I think maybe one could, I mean, what the question is, how much do you need to put in, right?
Well, probably more than is in the sharing box with no vertical gravity.
Oh, no kidding. But,
But it certainly appears that the issue of convergence, which says we understand the physics and we go beyond the linear problem by now doing a calculation. And then out of it comes a number. That it's a corrupt process right now, because if indeed it's a rough and smooth kind of a problem, you've been just working in the world of happy laminar flows, and the numbers are just screwy. You're on the wrong branch. And I think that's Gauss's arguments or statements about that were fairly persuasive. And we've often accepted calculations because they look like they're calculations, and they involve Zeus or something like that. And then a lot of defense of physics that is kind of wobbly beyond a certain point. The first time that problem was done was fine. It stimulated consideration, but it did not grow in a way that would be appropriate for actually trying to deal with a turbulent spectrum. And now Fausto would say, well, look, it's a real pain to do these problems. We certainly are building very large machines that will look for problems. The question is this a problem that deserves attention, or is it just kind of a, you more or less say, if I did the turbulence correctly, yeah, these disks would pump, and they would have some magnetic things involved, and it would work. It's not worth doing it. But if you think that it is worth doing it because it actually puts other constraints on it, then you might want to elevate it to the point of where you might like to convince either some young warriors or others to take this problem on. The computing resources exist, and although Fausto says, I don't want to deal with petabytes of data, well, never mind. We will build petabytes of machines. And is this in astrophysics one of those problems that may be on the same level of interest as, for instance, the large-scale structure of the universe, which will also use those machines?
Let me just make a comment about that. So I also found Fausto's arguments persuasive and kind of daunting. And so we could ask the question, is it actually worth trying to understand how accretion works in a disk with MRI, or should we just assume that nature will find a way to accrete? And I think for astrophysical purposes, it does matter, because there are alternatives to angular momentum transport, such as driving winds, which have a lot of bearing on the observations. And I think probably to get some sort of astrophysically interesting understanding of accretion, we do have to understand how this works.
If you're looking for selling points, I mean, you can tie it to planet formation, right? Which is a very popular thing these days.
Well, it's one thing to sell it, but it's appropriate to ask, is it a problem that has enough scientific importance in terms of implications that we might want to encourage someone to consider it.
Well, I think it would be interesting. I mean, I think it is an important, interesting problem, but I think it would be good maybe to finish the job that Fausto started and try to estimate what you really need in the way of resources.
Let's go back to that point. I didn't want to be, first I didn't want to be rude over you, but you say you use half a million non-hour with 64,000 CPU. It means that you haven't run your case for 9 hours on the computer. I mean,
what do you do with the rest of the day?
Yeah, exactly. 9 hours, that's a lot.
This is how it works. I mean, this was a machine at Watson. That it was there because they had two smaller machines that they were sending to Livermore. So we got a phone call and say, do you want a machine this weekend? Okay. With 64,000 processors. Now, how many people in this room have codes that, you know, with one day notice will run on a 64,000 processor? Not that much.
No.
And that was it. And then it's gone. So it's pointless that someone says, can you please run another one with different parameters? I don't have the machine anymore.
I mean, the machine you have, you are working with Argon. You have 300,000 CPUs.
I got a machine 2 months ago. So, okay, now we're going to use the Argon machine. But these are big machines that are a big pain in the ass to use.
Last comment.
Okay. I guess the last comment would be, I don't think that computing alone will solve the problem. And I think Edgar is absolutely right that there's still room for theory.
Oh, but that's not exclusion. I mean,
yeah, but if we go on that, on accretion disk, you have also the instability due to stratification that Jean-Paul has been pushing. Also, he has been pushing the fact that you can have non-linear instability even if you are really stable. So, I mean, you have other ways of getting your disk unstable and having alpha, which is the one we are looking for, the saturation I have. So, a lot of people have been concentrating on getting the alpha through the MRI, but you have certainly other way of getting instability. Stabilities in your disk besides having MRI. So if the question is, in terms of accretion disk, what transport angular momentum, is it MRI or another instability, then there is a lot of questions to be addressed, and you need to push your simulation as high as you can. If the question is MRI a physical process we want to understand as a physical process, not as a way of understanding accretion disk, then it's a different type of questions. And I don't know which one we want to address. I guess as an astrophysicist, we want to address the accretion problem and know what gets you the alpha of the Sakura-Sonnaïev problem. As a fluid dynamicist, you rather want to study MRI as a physical process. You know?
That's a good point. I mean, my own take on this, which might be slightly controversial, is that this problem seems to be a very interesting fluid dynamics problem which has been hijacked by the astrophysicists. Very strange to talk about accretion disks as a problem hijacked by the astrophysicists, but if you want to do a massive computation of the type that you're talking about, you have to convince a whole community of astrophysicists who think that they're doing the right thing with black holes, with the Hall effect, with cream cheese, with 32 cube points, that what you're doing is necessary. And they're carrying on doing these things, and they're telling everybody else, they're referring everybody else's papers and saying, you know, this has been done 15 years ago. And so whether you get back into the astrophysics community to do a calculation of that, I'm not so sure.
Steve is pointing at me, but my paper was rejected with a statement that this problem can only be done where.
How was he pointing?
There's no point in doing anything.
Several of us have had experiences like that, particularly with grant proposals.
Yeah.
By the way, is the mic still on for this?
Okay, we'll close the discussion.
But you certainly raise the issue that if we discuss the effectiveness of refereeing processes, and this is also referred to an AppJ editor, the intention is to send things to be refereed by those who might be cited as being in that community. And if it's a small community that itself feels very comfortable with what they think they understand, it's a very closed society. So that's a problem.
Yeah.
I think in getting the computing resources, there wouldn't be a problem. Getting money to support it is a different problem.
The issue is not, is this does this have scientific merit? It clearly does. The issue is how can you compete effectively with people with, you know, with problems that are also notorious. You sound like you're warming up for a SciDAC proposal.
But we have, you know, we're building machines. Okay. NSF will build an 800,000 processor machine, million core processor, and there will be a lot of resources. Yeah. On the other hand, what doesn't grow is sort of the mandate to have people paid salary to work on something. Yeah, sure.
Okay, I think it's been a long afternoon, so let's thank all the speakers again. Just to advertise.